You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome again to Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. And I'm very pleased to be able to introduce you to my guest today, because I'm pretty sure he's a name you haven't heard, but he is doing very important work in an area that is of great importance to me and indeed to the Blue Republican organization, which is helping the American people basically get out of the boxes of partisan thinking, the boxes of the mind that are the parties and partisan thinking. And his name is Chad Peace, and I would like to invite him right now to just introduce himself to all of you. Chad, over to you. Tell us a little bit about the organizations that you are officially affiliated with.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, Robin. I appreciate it. I'm legal counsel and consultant for the Independent Voter Project, which started in 2006 with the belief that we needed to get disenfranchised voters back into the election process. One of the things we want to clarify is that when we say independent voters, we define independent voters as those that have an independent mind. They can be found with any party affiliation, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, no affiliation. But really, they started with the focus testing and polling to find out ways that we could re-engage voters in the process. One of the things that the Independent Voter Project has accomplished was in 2010 authored the California's Nonpartisan Primary Initiative. That was successful in California, and so following that success, they came to me and asked, well, how can we bring this to a more national scale? How can we do something that really hits the institutionalization of the two parties, knowing that, one, the traditional money is going to be behind Republican and Democratic causes, and two, electoral reform isn't exactly the sexiest issue. So what we have put together is a coalitional effort, and so a co-founding member is the Independent Voter Project. I am the legal strategist for the coalition. And really, the coalition is backed by a strategy, a legal strategy that will be attacking the closed partisan primary structure on a state-by-state basis. We actually have one lawsuit prepared, ready to file in New Jersey, and we have a team of about 12 lawyers that are participatory in constructing argumentation and the memos to file this in additional states. But the important thing is that what we're bringing together is election reform groups, media organizations, a bunch of organizations that span the political spectrum to really advocate for three simple principles. We all have our own ideas and our own ideologies, tendencies, biases, and solutions. But really, these three core principles are found at the really at the basis of the complaint, and so it's natural that they form the basis of our coalition. Those principles are, one, that every voter has a fundamental right to vote at every stage of the election process. The second would be that every voter has the right to a fundamental vote unconditioned by joining a party, meaning you can't require somebody to register a Democrat or Republican to have a meaningful vote. And the third principle is that any activities of political parties that are conducted in a manner that exclude some voters from full participation or equal participation can't be taxpayer funded. So for those who are not aware, we did a preliminary study on another project of the Independent Voter Project is IVN.us. That's a news site. And we did a study last year that estimated that taxpayers spent about $500 million just on conducting partisan primaries alone. Now, these are pretty much just Republican and Democrat primaries where they're saying only our voters can participate. So part of, you know, the lawsuit and our legal strategy as well, if they want to exclude voters, if they want to change the rules along the process like they did to Ron Paul in 2012, well, then if they're going to act like private organizations, then they should fund themselves like private organizations.
So let me just see if I understand this, Chad. Now, that makes perfect sense, of course, that in as much as you're operating privately without a public interest, which brings to mind, I guess, the Equal Protection Clause, then you shouldn't be the recipient of taxpayer money, especially in as much as other people and other organizations are not recipients of said money. But are you objecting to the fact, I'm trying to understand the first couple of principles, are you actually objecting to the fact that there are private, private political parties that do want to hold exclusionary primaries?
Well, absolutely not. I'm glad you asked me that question. Is one thing we do want to make clear is that we're not anti-party. And it's our belief that the way to actually strengthen, depending on how you measure the strength of a party, a process that includes all voters would strengthen them by making them more accountable. If parties want to have their own primaries, want to conduct them themselves and have their own nominees where other voters can't participate, we think that's fine, that's completely acceptable, that's constitutional, but they shouldn't ask the taxpayers to fund that process. What the state has an obligation to do is provide an apparatus for everyone that may or may not want to join a party to have an equal, meaningful vote. So if a party has an apparatus to get onto the election ballot, the general election ballot, we have to give an equal, meaningful opportunity for other voters to participate as well.
Now, so does this mean essentially a lowering of the bar to zero for access to any election, you know, to candidacy for any election, even for a single individual?
Right, and that's an important question, because the natural question to that is, well, then what's your solution? How do you have ballot access requirements? In California, like I mentioned, the Independent Voter Project authored the top two nonpartisan primary. Now, even the organization itself doesn't suggest that that's the perfect solution in the perfect world. What we do believe is it's better than the old closed partisan system that we had. In terms of crafting, well, how do you balance needing to have some kind of ballot standard, right, but then also protecting the rights of the voters? That's really up to that's a legislator's job to do, and that's what the complaint would suggest. But what the complaint also suggests is that in anything that you're crafting, like the top two nonpartisan primary in California or Washington, the legislature can craft whatever they want as long as they respect those three constitutional principles that we're asserting on behalf of all voters.
Now we only have couple of minutes or 2 to 3 minutes in this segment, but is that enough time to actually just unpack what was wrong with the system as it was? Let's talk about California because you've had success there, and how the system works now, and what was changed to getting from one to the other?
Sure. Most basically, California had a system that was more like most traditional systems. The best way to conceive it is thinking about what the purpose of a primary is. So in almost every state, the purpose of the primary is to elect nominees for each party, right? So people are, okay, we go through the primary, who's the best Republican? Who's the best Democrat? So most simply what California did said, we're changing the purpose, and we're going to change it from a private purpose to elect a private nominee to a public purpose. So now in California, every candidate, regardless of your party, appears on the same primary ballot. Every voter, regardless of party or non-affiliation, votes on the same ballot. And then the top two candidates from that ballot, whatever party they are, they could be two of the same. They could be an independent and a Republican, a Democrat and a Green. whatever it is, the top two go on. So they change the purpose from one that's private to one that's public, so that it's not to elect party nominees, but rather to winnow the field of candidates for the general election.
But presumably this doesn't stop the Republicans or the Democrats or even indeed any other party from having whatever mechanism, including something that they might call a primary, for choosing who goes to the primary that you're talking about.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly right. Parties are more than welcome to have another apparatus or another process that they use independent of that. But what this process does is make sure that anything that's taxpayer-funded, there's an equal playing field. And that goes for voters, candidates, parties, everybody.
Okay, so now, because now, I know there's been quite a bit of objection to the top two system. I'm up here in Washington, because it allows, basically, you know, you get two Democrats going forward to the top two, and then when it comes to the election, that is, you know, where you have all of the, I'm sorry, you know what, I'm going to hold this thought and ask you this question after in the next segment, because
sure.
We're going to break. Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious, and I'm speaking to Chad Peace, and we are talking about the problems of partisanship, and you might say the duopolistic political lockdown of our electoral system by the Republicrats. Now, Chad, we were just talking before we finished the last segment there about the top two system that's been instituted in California and in Washington, where I am. Now, the problem, it seems, the obvious problem with the top two system, whereby the candidates who receive the most votes in the open primary go on the ballot for the actual election. I mean, there are only two of them, and they may well be from the same party, but they certainly will not be from more than two parties, which in 99.9% of cases means, you know, they're either both Democrats, both Republicans, or a Republican and a Democrat. That by the time you actually get to this election, you have certainly no more choice and no wider range of political philosophies to choose from. It actually kind of looks on the surface that it adds to the power of the Republicans and Democrats to lock down our electoral system.
Right. Well, I appreciate that question, and I think that's an important one to really expand on, because there has been, you know, opposition from third parties and other other activists and other objections for that very reason. I think so. There's a couple things I want to present before I really get into the substance of it. But one, I think it's important to understand that I myself think top two nonpartisan primary was a step forward. I think there's a lot of discussion that needs to continue to occur about the merits of other systems. I know there's groups working for instant runoff, approval voting, proportional. I think these are all good conversations to have, and don't want to confuse an advocacy for the advancement in California and Washington as me being so dogmatic about this is the perfect solution in the perfect world. I think another important issue to understand is that this is a very voter-centric cause and not a candidate or party-centric cause. And when you think of it in terms of the voter, right, we could have the system in Washington and California are now designed to be more responsive to all voters, right? So even in districts where you...
In what way, Chad? Just explain that for us.
Right. So before the under... We can start by talking about like a traditional system where if you think about it, there's a book called Who Stole My Cheese? Or or you can think about it as, which just can't amount to incentives. Where do you put the incentives for the candidates? Where's the cheese for the candidates? Under most systems, and if it's a Republican or a Democratic primary, they're incentivized to act and to represent the small partisan base that turns out in their primaries.
Sure.
Right? And we've seen in the Republican primaries, when that small activist base isn't going to produce a result they like, then they go and change the rules. So that's kind of beside the point. But what the Washington and California system has done is it broadens the base of voters that they're accountable to. So you could either, one, have the exact same candidate, or two, have two candidates from the exact same party, but under the new system, they're accountable to new people.
Now, hold on, Chad. Just let me see if I understand this, just if you don't mind. Hold on. So, since the Republicans and the Democrats can still run their private primaries, how actually do you net increase accountability? I mean, they can still choose their candidates to go forward to the public ballots through the same mechanisms, if I understand you right, that will give, you know, power probably, you know, to the harder right among the conservatives and to the harder left among the liberals. So explain, I'm still not quite getting how this solves this problem.
Right. So, well, the only mechanism for placement on the general election ballot is the nonpartisan state-run primary, right? So that's any state-sponsored, taxpayer-funded primary is the mechanism for placement on the general election ballot. And so when you make that the mechanism for placing candidates on the ballot and you equalize the playing field for all voters, candidates, and parties, right, you start off with an equal playing field. And a lot of the arguments that you're articulating, which I think there is legitimacy within those arguments, is that it's focused on, well, the reduction of choices on the general election ballot. The point that we're making is that right now the meaningful vote occurs in the primaries. 95% of elections are de facto decided in the primaries, and the general elections are largely a show. And that's done by a combination of gerrymandering, just cultural norms within communities, and ballot access laws. So what we've done is, in understanding that really the meaningful vote, the vote that occurs, that really elects people, occurs in the primary, is equalize the playing field during that important process. And so even if the field is reduced to just two parties on the general election ballot, we know that from the onset of that political process, everyone was given an equal opportunity to express a vote.
Except that the candidates who do go to the state primary that have an R or a D next to their name, they need to go through their own party mechanisms, and they're still going to benefit from all of their party money. So they still have a massive advantage. Surely, just as if all that you did was ensure that you made, as if you had easier access to everybody, a lower bar for entry, as it were, to the final ballot, the final election ballot. Do you see what I mean? Then you end up in the same place. It's like what you've really done is split the general ballot at the end of the process into two and called the first part of it the primary, and the thing that was the primary, the party primaries, now, well, maybe they have to give themselves another name, but they're still there. Am I still missing the point?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, because, one, the parties have the right to nominate and say, this is our guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The way it is on Washington and California no longer have party voter registration by party. And so candidates are not placed on... I'm sorry?
That's really important, that to make sense of this, isn't it? I think that's a really important piece of this.
Well,
right?
No, it is important. I didn't know you wanted to go that deep.
Yeah, you've got an hour, Chad. I want to understand this, and I want all the listeners to understand. This is a
so both watch.
Yeah.
Right, and as it applies to constitutional matters, it's important to understand, too, is that Washington actually traditionally never had voter registration by party. California actually switched from a voter affiliation to a party preference. So when candidates run on the ballot, they actually, their indication is, if they're a Republican, it says party preference Republican, or party preference Democrat, or party preference none. which means you could have multiple Republicans. You could go through the Republicans' private process and say, I'm the Republican nominee, but you may get challenged by another Republican that has more support than you. So in California, I think a really good example of this is what happened to Peter Stark and Eric Swalwell. They're both Democrats, but Peter Stark was a 22-year congressman in California, one of the furthest left congressmen, bitterly partisan, and had never even faced a challenge in his congressional race, no credible challenge in 22 years. This past election, which I think, I also want to clarify, I think the effects of nonpartisan primary are going to take some cycles before people really understand how the dynamics have changed. But despite that, Eric Swalwell, another Democrat, went into that district, and he went out and he said his motivation was, I'm going to talk to Republicans, I'm going to talk to Libertarians, I'm going to talk to Greens, and I'm going to talk to Independents, and that's how I'm going to win. So if you Google the Boston Globe, there's actually, it's pretty hilarious, is that they interview Peter Stark and say, how do you lose? And he says, I don't know. I had the endorsement of the Obama administration. I had the endorsement of every union, every Democratic organization. He had no endorsements, and I had a lot more money, and he still won. And so the next paragraph is Eric Swalwell. He said, well, how did you win? He goes, well, it was very simple. He locked up all the partisan Democratic voters, and I went and talked to everyone else, which I call regular people.
Wonderful. You know what? That's perfectly timed, Chad. Leave it right there because we're going in into the next break. So we're going to take off from there in a few. Brilliant. Thank you.
Great.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome back to the Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious and indeed the Non-Dogmatic, and I am speaking to Chad Peace, whose work is basically focused on three fundamental principles, it seems. One is that the right to vote is fundamental. Two is that the right to vote cannot be abridged by a requirement to join any organization. And three, public funds should not be used to subsidize activities of political parties, which are private organizations, that abridge a voter's right to meaningful participation in the election process. I've got that right, haven't I, Chad?
It's pretty good.
Okay, great, because I'm actually reading that off one of your documents, so it should be pretty close. Now I just want to summarize what we've got to in the last couple of seconds, because I think it's really important, and I think I've learned something from you, specifically with respect to the upside of the top two system, because there's a lot more to the top two system than just the fact that in that last the actual, what you might call the general election, the final election, there are only two candidates. The point I think we've got to, which is critically important, is that the election that precedes that one allows numerous candidates to state a party preference such that the voter cannot tell, based on looking at that document, at the ballot sheet, who is blessed by the establishment of the party and who is not, which means that I could be a big party-funded, multi-million-dollar, long-standing Democrat, and my name appears with a D preference, but right next to me is a grassroots guy who may have a completely different feel about where his party should be going. He may even object to what he sees as establishment partisan shenanigans, and he may, just as in the example you gave, rather than just spending big party dollars, he may actually go knocking on doors and maybe build bridges rather than being more partisan to get the party endorsement. He may go about building bridges. And in so doing, as people like that see more success, they get to steer the party away from what the party privateers want it to be, more towards what the actual voters, the grassroots membership of the party want it to be. Is that fair?
I think it's pretty fair, and I like to express it in terms of accountability. What I think it does is it makes the parties, any party, more accountable to the broader base of the electorate. Which I think one of the critiques we have today is that representatives seem to represent their party more than their constituency. But if you change the structure so they're accountable to everybody, maybe we'll see representatives doing a better job of representing really the breadth of their constituency rather than a small sliver of.
Right. And so what we're trying to do here is move from top-down party politics more to bottom-up party politics, yeah?
I suppose.
Okay. Now, let's say I'm a libertarian or a green, how do I make this change work for me? Why would I be benefiting from this as a minor party? And then perhaps as an individual and unaffiliated?
This is a perfect question. Thank you for the question. I'll proceed my answer by saying, if you haven't read it already, the chairman of the Washington State Libertarian Party wrote an excellent piece talking about how third parties like the Libertarian Party can take advantage of top two.
Chad, just before you go on, I want to endorse what you just said. I read that piece and I liked it so much that I actually gave it quite a lot of publicity on through the Blue Republican channels. His name is C. Michael Pickens. He's a great guy. I work with him, and he knows what he's talking about. So yes, sorry, yeah. Back to you. Yeah.
Right. It was a fantastic piece, and it shows that he really gets it, and that really I'll also clarify that, you know, on a personal level, you know, I really got engaged in politics because, you know, my business partner is sitting right next to me, Anthony Astolfi, and I got involved in the early Rand Paul stuff back in 2007, helping out the money bombs and doing that kind of stuff. And really what drew us in was the authenticity of Ron Paul more than anything else. Since then, we may,
I'm going to have to interrupt you. Hold on to your story. This is a short segment.
Sure.
We're going to come back in a couple more minutes. Thank you for being with the Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. And I'm talking to Chad Peace, and he was just starting to tell us a little story, I think, about how he kind of came to politics and his experience with Ron Paul. Right back to you, Chad. Carry on.
All right. My business partner and I, we kind of got energized during the old Ron Paul days and the early money bombs. And, you know, one thing I like to make clear is that this, what we're working on now, is it's not about an ideology. It's about a mindset. So we're working with groups everywhere from independent voting, who comes from back in the old reform movement, to organizations across the political spectrum. But how that relates to the question, you know, you asked before about how can third parties take advantage of this a top two type system, is we see this, that the third parties right now, the parties use them, you know, to play spoiler and to distract votes from other candidates on the general election ballot. If the third parties like the Libertarians and the Greens saw this as a strategic opportunity, you know, I don't know the landscape of Washington as well as you do, but I know California pretty well. For example, in in San Francisco, I see an opportunity for a Green Party candidate to align with, to make a deal with libertarians, to make a deal with American decent freedom, to make a deal with independent advocacy groups, and say, you know, we're going to put resources and we're all going to advocate for a Green Party candidate in San Francisco. Because there's a situation where if you put a Green Party candidate head-to-head, so if they got past the top two primary and they went head-to-head against a Democrat, a Green Party candidate could actually win. And now if you took that same mentality down into San Diego, those of you who are not familiar with San Diego, it is a very libertarian city. And that there's districts in that city where if you ran a credible libertarian candidate and you had the support of Green Party, independent, you know, blue Republican type organizations, and you really put all of your efforts behind the libertarian candidate to get passed into the general election so it were head-to-head libertarian v. Republican, they could not ignore the importance of that libertarian candidate in San Diego or that Green Party candidate in San Francisco. And whereas now the third parties have really just played a role of speaking to the relatively small number of voters that actually listen enough to hear them in a political debate, we could actually get third party and independent candidates into office. But it requires a real strategic approach. As you mentioned earlier, it requires thinking about things in terms of coalition building rather than dividing. And so I really see it as an opportunity. I think the chairman of the Republican Party in Washington did a very good job of articulating that. And I hope to see more of that thought process going on among the third party advocates and independent advocates.
Yeah, there's no doubt that that people who want to change America, certainly people in third parties, more independently minded people, we have to get strategic. We have to get pragmatic. You know, work with what we've got, so to speak.
Right.
Rather than, in many cases, standing on our kind of, what do they call it, you know, those ideological pedestals and the pushing this kind of purism, which has kept the Democrats and Republicans in power across the board for way too long. I think we're all ready for a bit of a change. Stepping back from just like the top two things specifically, can you tell us a little bit about just how, I mean, your specialization is on the legal side, right, Chad? How is it that maybe at the federal level, maybe in various states, the duopoly, the Republican duopoly, has the system locked down in their favor? How much of our money are they getting that nobody else can get? And legally, just in terms of rules, how is the system biased towards them?
Right. Well, I think the first thing in going into all this is you have to understand that there's credible arguments and there's a very authentic belief. I don't think that's the people that would even oppose maybe what we're doing or advocates of the two-party system are necessarily bad or insincere. I think there are a number of people that sincerely believe that a strong, you know, two-party, institutionalized two-party system is the best way to promote democracy. I think that the current state of affairs is evidence that that's not the case. But to your point about how they've institutionalized themselves, it's been slowly over the years where most of us are familiar with gerrymandering, but there's lots of different ways in which the parties have institutionalized themselves. If you go into the courtroom, right, we can see arguments that the courts have made, that the parties have made. I mean, the Republican Party, you know, the irony is this, the Republican Party in Washington, for example, argued against their system that their private right of association. It was the Democratic Party in California that argued against California's old open primary system. So what they've done is they've gone into court and established a precedent that party activities are private affairs. And by doing that, you know, that's one piece of their institutionalization puzzle that they've been able to keep people out of the process. They've been able to keep third parties off from having meaningful participation by making absurd ballot requirements. You know, before California leveled the playing field, so before 2012, you had to get some ridiculous, like 10,000 times as many ballot signatures to run for a statewide office. But if you were a Republican or a Democrat, you just needed like 200 signatures and a $2,000 check. You know,
so on, are you actually saying, Chad, that the, I mean, this seems to be equal, it seems to just defy equal protection, doesn't it? I mean, it just seems blatantly to defy protection. If I affiliate myself with, as a private individual with a private organization, the standard that, that I must meet to put myself in a certain position in relation to the public is lower than if I am not affiliated with one of those organizations. I mean, that's just, right. Is there any defense for that, or am I misunderstanding?
Right. But no, I think from, you know, a unbiased, you know, viewpoint, yeah, I think you're exactly right. But when you think about it in the context that almost every single legislator in office is a Republican or a Democrat elected under the system. Almost every judge is appointed by people who were elected under that system. And so, over time, you get the modicum of change, and all the institutionalized power and the money that would support such a system, you know, backs it up. It's really difficult because how do you change the system? Well, first, you have to have enough either money or advocacy to undo those rules and overcome those precedents that their high-paid lawyers have been paid to establish in court. So, really, that goes to what we feel like we're doing with this coalition is banding together a lot of groups who, on our own, don't have enough, you know, boots to really take on what is a monumental system and say, "Hey, you're right. This is unfair." I mean, you said it exactly right. It's not fair. So why don't we, instead of fighting amongst each other over our perfect solutions, say, "Let's take on the process problem." You know, the foundation of how we're elected and represented in the first place, so that we can have these other ideological battles out in the public, whereas right now, you know, the number of interested people having substantive political conversations is relatively small.
And is this problem evident at all levels of the ballot process? I mean, you know, from like governor through down to the, you know, people running for their state congress, all the way down to, I don't know, councillor, school board. I mean, what levels is this really an issue? And by the way, we've only got about a minute left in this segment, so a quick answer if you can.
So I'll try to answer it quick. I think it ends up trickling down, you know, through media and other ways to every portion of our political process. But, you know, nonpartisan primaries are established in almost all local elections. So I don't think it's a coincidence that we tend to be more satisfied with our local representatives.
Mm.
I think the biggest culprits of the problem are our state legislatures and Congress in Washington, where the institutionalization, the partisan primary process has really created an atmosphere where we're encouraged to be divided, representatives are encouraged to act divisively, and that we really don't have that nonpartisan representation, which really should arrive, we believe, in the individual right to vote and express their opinion.
Thanks, Chad. Thank you very much. We'll be back for the final segment in a few minutes. Everywhere to the final segment of my show here, where I, Robin Kernan, am speaking to Chad Peace. And in the last couple of minutes, I want to ask Chad just to give you all ways that you can support his efforts to kind of break down the partisanship that has really is keeping American politics stuck in the mud. Chad, where should people go who are interested to find out more about what you've been talking about, or indeed to support your efforts?
Well, the coalition is formed on endpartisanship.org. There you can find, you know, the basic principles and overview of what we're doing and stay updated. There's the petition. If you sign the petition, we'll make sure we keep you informed. We have our first conference call tomorrow to give a little more substantive information on where we're headed.
Now, Chad, that's tomorrow when we're recording this. That's not tomorrow when this goes out, right?
Oh, yeah, that's correct.
Okay, carry on.
Go to endpartisanship.org, sign up. We have an increasing base of volunteers, which we're organizing to promote this effort. This is as much a PR venture as it is a legal venture, because a lot of the legal stuff is going to depend on how much we can push this into the public dialogue. We know that the parties and the people who oppose us are going to brand this and try to make it out to be, you know, this type of reactionary people, or pigeonhole us as this type of ideology. But really the goal is to make this a coalition that spans the political spectrum, to make it known that this is not an ideological fight. It's a fight for fundamental voting, right? And really, we have a lot of, we're already building the development to, establish a infrastructure for organizing. We're helping organizers on a state-by-state basis.
Chad, we're going to have to wrap it up because we're about to finish. And I just also want to give a shout-out to OpenDebate2016.com, which is very much in the same spirit of ending partisanship that you're talking about here. Thanks for joining me, Chad. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much, Robin.
Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.